Hey, how are you doing? It's 2022. I thought I'd try something different given that it's a new year, a new dawn, and I'm feeling good. That's a lie. I'm not feeling very good. I think I thought that somehow everything would change with the turning of the year. And then, of course, you discover that nothing has changed. All the news stories remain the same. I don't know how you feel, but I've kind of got to the point where I don't really want to hear the word COVID, or lateral flow test ever again. However, given that it's a new year, I thought I'd try something different because we're 4 months away from the council elections, and I think there's going to be council elections in England as well. And the Scottish Conservative Party is in uproar at the moment because they feel as if they've been held responsible for the failings of the Tory Party in England, and there's now concern that the high watermark from 2017, when the Tory Party in Scotland did fairly well in the council elections because of the so-called Ruth Davidson effect. It's now looking as if they might get blamed for what's been happening down south with the number 10 parties and trying to defend Owen Paterson and others and trying to rewrite the rules for MPs to facilitate the saving of a trusted insider or an old friend at the expense of all the new intake MPs who might get hammered in the backlash in the next election. So Johnson has been acting in ways that have kind of alienated a lot of his own support and have terrified those who are facing election in 4 months' time, four and a half months, four a bit months' time. So I thought I would start actually opening up a wee bit and actually just talk about the issues of the day first in the UK generally and then specifically in Scotland, rather than tie myself to a particular piece in The Guardian, because The Guardian. If you've read The Guardian for as long as I have, you could write it. A bit like fireworks displays, it just you wouldn't know whether you were watching last year's or not because it's the same thing. So if the Guardian journalists say anything new, then I'll maybe revert back to looking at something specific. But at the minute they're stuck in a pro-lockdown, pro-EU, anti-Johnson routine of continued revisiting of the same issues. Not that they've never got a point. Sometimes they have got a point. I was reading this morning about the regressive nature of the National Insurance levy that's going to kick in 4 months' time, and even John Major, the former Tory Prime Minister, is against that. As he says, if they're going to fund social care, they should fund it out of general taxation. National insurance is a terrible tax. But the reason why national insurance continues, and I'm going to make a number of points later on about what dismays me about politics. The reason why national insurance continues is precisely because people don't care to understand anything really about politics. It all bores them. Or alternatively, maybe they're actually stuck in a behavioural rut where they like being upset. But there's something awfully strange about democratic politics. Plato noted this 2,500 years ago, and nothing much has changed. Democracies have got internal dynamics which are extremely difficult to understand or reconcile yourself to. You wonder what it is in folk that allows them to continue to bang their head against a brick wall when there's a door. Yesterday I came close to losing my temper because the anti-SNP pro-union side in Scotland continually talk about the parties need to work together, and it goes on and on and on and on. And no matter how many times you point out that the parties couldn't agree to work together because it would sabotage them in different ways, each of the major parties couldn't afford to stand down candidates and therefore demoralise their party. Not only is that an impossibility, but there's an easier way to achieve the same outcome by just changing the electoral system. And what you discover with party politics and fringe party politics, as I say, I'm a member of a WhatsApp group. What you discover is that folk don't really care about success. They care about their route to success, and they care that that be continually championed. So they keep chuntering on. They can't stop themselves. So if someone says that the parties need to work together, they'll keep saying the parties need to work together, and they'll say it for years on end. And no matter how many times you invite them to contemplate your alternative route to the goal that they claim to desire, no matter how many times you tell them that you've got a PhD in politics and it's at least worth considering that you might be right, they're never going to do it. They'll never stop. They will never take a check pace. And that kind of doggedness, that kind of insistence on just a behavioural routine or a verbal routine, and to just keep it going, is everywhere. And it's not just in the anti-vaxxers that, you know, are in the news today, because a prominent anti-vaxxer in Italy has just died. It's in the Gardenistas and the critics and the progressives and the woke and the unwoke. I came very close to falling out with somebody on Twitter that I follow, and I think it's quite good, Effie Deans. I think she's a university lecturer. And she continually revisits this issue about gender and sex. And essentially her position is, it's all a lot of nonsense. Everything that's happening today apropos gender and sex is a lot of nonsense. And consequently, she kind of takes seriously what the opponents are saying, those who are probably rightly thought to be woke. What exactly is it in the woke agenda regarding gender, which you have to understand in order to understand how to avoid the worst aspects of their case? In other words, if you want to avoid having XY chromosome males breaking the arms and legs of women in combat sports, what is it you have to understand about the pitch that the so-called woke are making about social reform? And Effie, for some reason, will continually deny what in other occasions she accepts, which is that there is a distinction between sex and gender. So you people across the board dismiss John Stuart Mill's old nostrum, which is, if you know only your own case, you don't know much about it. You have to understand your opponent's case as well, and you have to understand it as well as you understand your own, so that you can address what's true in their case and then defeat them on the grounds of what's false. And what we've got ourselves into in the last couple of years are these behavioural ruts. And it was always the case. It's been true, as I've said before, for as long as we've had democratic institutions, that there are huge problems in getting folk to take seriously the detail. A slogan will always beat a programme. But the last 2 years of lockdown, I think, have exacerbated things. I was watching somebody on the Joe Rogan podcast talking about the effect it has on people when you separate them and frighten them, get them on their own and then collectively frighten them. And they lose their ability to actually reflect on their stance. People who are frightened will actually pull a door until they pull the handle off the door before they'll push it, because they just get into a behavioural rut. A bit like animals deciding to walk in a particular direction. A small change in direction might save them, but once they've actually got into a real behavioural rut, they'll keep going until they die of dehydration, even if salvation was a short distance away, because it involves modifying their behaviour. And once they're in that behavioural rut, which might well exist for good reasons, maybe when you're frightened it's important to do what the leader says, maybe when you're frightened it's important to close ranks and to suppress dissent, but in the right circumstances, that same loyalty and that same doggedness will get you killed. And it seems as if we've got ourselves into a terrible rut. So just looking at this, one of today's news stories is the death of this Italian high-profile anti-vaxxer, who, in common with a number of other anti-vaxxers, has died of COVID. Now, I should say, I've had two doses of the vaccine, AstraZeneca. I've not had the third because I heard what the Porton Down, I think, scientist said apropos a third dose. It doesn't seem to have much effect on illness and might have a very modest effect on transmission. And consequently, I find it very difficult to accept that we should continue down this rabbit hole of worrying about triple vaccines for people who are double vaccinated, when we know that the problem is almost entirely of people that haven't been vaccinated at all. So I've been vaccinated, and consequently I might be on the wrong side of the argument for some people who are virulent anti-vaxxers and possessed of all kinds of beliefs about the supposed COVID conspiracy and the New World Order and the Great Reset. What I find difficult, however, is the, as it were, pro-establishment, pro-vaccine, pro-the orthodoxy, pro-Dr. Fauci. What I find difficult is that group seem to label, stigmatise, group every single thing that is thoughtful and dissenting with all the things which are thoughtless and stupid. So in other words, the kind of rambling nonsense that gets an anti-vaxxer killed because they won't take a vaccine, which is almost anyone's judgment is relatively innocuous compared to other things, and certainly for the target groups, for the groups most likely to be affected by COVID, the vaccine is much better than the illness. That great truth, which is that the vaccines have been miraculous for the most affected groups, that is thought to be such a central truth of the new religion that you can't actually say some of the other things, like, for example, that the evidence for benefits of the vaccine in the very young is slight, that the risk for some negative reactions, negative side effects of the vaccine for the very young seems more significant, and that plenty of good paediatricians and others have said that you can't really justify giving the vaccine to small children. Now, that's not to be on the side of the anti-vaxxers. To say something like that is not to say something which is puts you in the same category as the folk who are just deranged and conspiracy theorists. To say that the disease is very, very mild in the young is simply to speak the truth. To say that the disease kills mainly the very old and those with huge comorbidities is simply to speak the truth. And what's worrying about the way we're going on is that we can't seem to understand that to be possessed of the idea that there's much stupidity in the opponents of vaccination, right? And there is a huge amount of stupidity in the opponents of vaccination. To be possessed of that idea, there's huge stupidity in the opponents of vaccination, and then to not be able to actually say anything about the questioning dissenting case that exists and has been sound for 2 years seems to me to be just as stupid as the Italian anti-vaxxer who gets COVID and kills himself thereby. There is real stupidity in not knowing who Jay Bhattacharya is. People who are strongly in favour of vaccination and are strongly in favour of lockdowns and on face masks and all the rest of it, if they can't tell you who Jay Bhattacharya is and what the Great Barrington Declaration is, they are every bit as thick and irresponsible and anti-democratic as the anti-vaxxers. The Edinburgh Professor Woolhouse, the epidemiologist, who said lockdown was a mistake, we did it because we had no idea what else to do and we should never do it again. He had no traction whatsoever. That was published in major newspapers, that statement, and it had no traction whatsoever, because we've got us into a conceptual frame where anything like that gets dismissed, even if it's a moderate, temperate thing said by an expert. And the same, of course, is true for Ioannidis. Right at the very start, the Stanford professor, John Ioannidis, I think, told us that COVID was 50 to 80 times more prevalent in the community than people thought, and therefore the infection fatality rate was very low. People don't know that. People don't know that when we looked at that cruise ship that had nothing but old people on it, it looked as if the infection fatality rate, even among that very vulnerable group, was way, way lower than what the Italian authorities had been claiming at the start. People don't know. They don't know that Gupta, the epidemiologist at Oxford, has been hugely critical of the whole approach that we've taken. They don't know that Loughborough University did a study and showed that COVID deaths were being hugely overstated, from memory, between 56 and 63%. They don't care to think that recently we had 30,000 flu deaths, and of course those were recorded as flu deaths. In other words, flu was instrumental in causing the death, despite the fact that most flu deaths that result in pneumonia, which caused the death, aren't recorded as flu deaths. So in actual fact, flu deaths have been huge in recent years, and flu deaths have been massively understated in recent years. If we actually took the standard for flu deaths that we take for COVID, which is you tested positive for flu in the previous 28 days and then you died, if we took that standard and compared like with like, the flu death totals from a few years ago would be off the scale, massive. And yet we never think like that. We don't think as social scientists should and as scientists should. And we group everybody who says anything critical about what the authorities say, that they received wisdom, even when the received wisdom is itself a reversal of what the same authorities had said shortly before. So the authorities tell you there's little evidence that masks work. Then they change their mind on slim evidence, and the people in actual fact who've got academic articles that demonstrate that the evidence is incredibly slim find that they can hardly get their articles published, because it becomes a heresy to say that masks don't work. The instant the authorities who had previously said that masks don't work say that they do. So the instant the people in charge reverse themselves, we forget that they said the opposite. We simply say, well, that's what they're saying now, so I'm going to believe that. I'm going to accept that. I'm going to accept that their authority is unimpeachable despite the fact they've just reversed themselves. Now, the old saw used to be, the old saying used to be, what does the layman do when the experts disagree? Well, we've got us in a position where the experts are actually reversing themselves and we still give them full credit for everything that they say. And to note that, to point that out, is not to be an anti-vaxxer. It is not to be a conspiracy theorist. It is not to be an idiot, to use Tony Blair's words. It's enough to drive you to drink. I don't drink anymore. This, of course, is the time of New Year resolutions. And some people will be committing themselves to the dry January, you know, not drinking during the month of January. Jeremy Clarkson said something interesting about 20 years ago. He was talking about how people drink too much, far too much, but not nearly enough. And he said he'd got drunk with these pals, Hammond May, James May and Richard Hammond. He'd got plastered the night before, and he said it was fantastic. So we laughed hysterically for like 4 hours. And he says that kind of drinking, which is like a kind of joyous celebratory, mateish drinking of large volumes in a social setting. He says that's a very different thing from what actually happens, which is people morosely and repetitively drinking every single day to a significant degree, just as a matter of routine. And a lot of people, as I say, are going to try for a dry January. But just to make this, again, the same point I made a moment ago regarding COVID, it's interesting just how utterly resistant to new information people are when they've had the information that they think they need and that's enough and they'll get on with it and rely on that. How many people actually know that there's no health benefit in drinking small amounts of alcohol? This is the latest thinking. There is no health benefit. There's a tiny group of, I think, women in their 50s who might be better having one unit of alcohol. But for the population as a whole, there is no health benefit. We're told that the group of people who drink small amounts of alcohol will live longer than the group who don't drink at all. I was on an American academic or health insurance website the other night, and the fact that I don't drink means that I'll live on average 2.4 years less than I would if I drank small amounts. Now, of course, this is complete rubbish, and we know this is complete rubbish, and it's not difficult to understand why. There's been quite a lot of popular books recently, like Freakonomics, that try to get people to think as a social scientist would. Go back 25 years, and I was very suspicious about this advice that drinking small amounts of alcohol had this great effect, this great positive effect. And I suspected what they now pretty much know to be true, which is it's just an artifact of the groups. It's a statistical aberration caused by the nature of the groups. If you think about the group of people who don't drink at all, it is stuffed full of recovered alcoholics who will have long-term health consequences their whole life. But more importantly, it's also stuffed full of people who have got undiagnosed health problems who will feel ill if they drink. So they drink a small amount of alcohol and they feel very unwell. So they don't drink at all. So that group contains a lot of people who are seriously ill, that group of teetotalers. Whereas the group of people who drink, that group contains people who can drink without feeling seriously ill. And because alcohol is toxic and gives you bowel cancer, you want to drink as little of it as possible. So you either have to drink a tiny amount and be in the group of drinkers, or you have to drink nothing at all and statistically be in the group of non-drinkers. Now, if you don't drink at all and you're not a recovered alcoholic and you can drink without feeling unwell, then you will probably live a very long time, or you'll have the longest life expectancy. But from a statistical point of view, they can't discover that group so easily. It's very hard to discover the group of teetotalers who can drink and enjoy it and metabolize alcohol, who aren't recovered alcoholics, but who choose not to drink. That's a very hard to identify group. So when you look at the global group of drinkers versus non-drinkers, what you're going to discover is that the group of drinkers contains people who can drink, obviously, because they're drinkers. And because they drink, and drink is poisonous and gives you bowel cancer, you want to drink as little as possible. And that's why the group of people who drink small amounts of alcohol live longer than anybody else. It's because drinking small amounts of alcohol gives you less bowel cancer than being a recovered alcoholic or having a metabolic problem that means you can't drink at all gives you other diseases. Now, this sounds complicated, but in actual fact, it's very simple if you think it through. The trouble is, we're not very keen on thinking things through. There's no market for this kind of talk. People want to know what they should do. Should I drink or shouldn't I drink? If you try to talk to somebody about a financial product and why its characteristics are such that if a certain thing happens, a disaster will follow, they're not really interested. What they want you to tell them is whether they should buy it or not. And as I say, whether it's COVID or anything else, this attitude that I'm really not prepared to think this through and I'm really not prepared to revisit decisions I've made earlier, they're good enough and I'm going to stick with them. This is not only maddening for people who would look to influence you, like, for example, me and politicians, it's also completely and utterly self-sabotaging and it produces huge amounts of human misery. Churchill, I think, said that most human misery could be avoided with insurance. There is no greater insurance against misery than actually listening closely to what people say and reading closely what's written, and then try to use your reason to navigate the world. And we've never been great at it. And for the last couple of years, we've rehearsed the worst aspects of our unreceptiveness. We've become very, very vulnerable to the next shock. On the subject of the next shock, have you heard of Evergrande? Probably not. There's a Chinese property company and it's very highly leveraged, huge amounts of debt. And the thing that debt does is it means that when things go wrong, they go very wrong quickly for the people who own the asset because they have to pay the debt, the interest on the debt, and the debt holders have first call on the assets. Usually that's how the debt is drawn up. A woman called Dambisa Moyo, I think it was in How the West Was Lost. Dambisa Moyo was talking about how the reason why we end up in these financial crises is because the debt holders are asleep on the job. Because if you own the company, if you're the ordinary shareholder, you want as much volatility as possible, preferably upward volatility, but you want to take big chances because your maximum gains are unlimited and your maximum losses are limited to your investment. So you want to actually throw a Hail Mary pass and either score a touchdown or go bust trying, because there's nothing to be gained from doing anything more modest. For the bondholders, however, there's nothing to be gained from doing anything other than being modest, because they can only get their interest. That's all they can get. They can't do any better than that. Now, Evergrande, as I say, is a property company, and it's looking very vulnerable. And if it goes bust, then the consequences worldwide for the financial markets could be quite severe. The reason why this matters, and again, it's a running theme, is that folk find it extremely difficult to change their views about anything, whether it's COVID or alcohol or property as an investment or anything else. So, for example, if you invest in your pension and the pension fund owns property, that's a very, what's called an illiquid asset. It means that you essentially can't actually pay the investors back their money without selling properties. And if you sell properties in a collapsing market, then that's the worst possible time to sell. I own a little bit of commercial property and I own it in what's called an investment trust, which means that if anybody tries to sell out when things are going badly, they just have to take the market price. We don't have to sell the properties. So people who want to bail out will have to take a very low market price, and me and the other investors who want to troop on will keep our properties. Now, again, you can't persuade people of this. You absolutely can't persuade people to think for 2 seconds about the difference between the property fund that they saw in the Sunday Times and the other property fund, which won't be destroyed in a downturn. There's just something in humanity. There's just something in people that means that this, it's, when I was a teacher, I'll use foul language now to make the point. When I was a teacher, you would always have the occasional sort of 16, 17-year-old person, usually a girl. For some reason, females, I think, have more trouble with middle-aged males than they do with middle-aged females, and vice versa. Boys respond better to men who are a bit like their father. But if you've got a girl from a sort of troubled educational background, she would either say or would love to say, "You talk a lot of shite," as we say in Scotland. And that tendency to just treat anything which just seems one step too far, anything that isn't a statement, you should do X, you shouldn't do X, anything that actually says, here's the reason why you shouldn't do X, because this follows from this other thing, that's all nonsense. It's just rubbish. You just talk a lot of crap. You just tie yourself in knots. You're just basically waffling on and on. You just talk a lot of junk, right? Now, I would be perfectly happy to accept that kind of lofty condescension and contempt from folk on one condition. When they get spattered all over the world, when they lose everything, when they're completely destroyed for the want of the kind of prudence and foresight and thought and caution and insurance that a little bit of thought would have given them, when they get completely destroyed, could they just be quiet about it and not blame anybody else? Because I don't mind people buying financial products or investing in dodgy schemes like, for example, Bitcoin and women empowering women and various car leasing schemes. I'd be perfectly happy for them to do that, as long as they don't then come along and ask for the rest of the population to bail them out, because that invariably is what happens. People will buy a flat that has got dodgy cladding all over it, and if the price goes up, they'll happily sell it and take the profits. But if the dodgy cladding makes the flat unsaleable, they'll never for 1 minute think they should take the losses. They'll insist that the public bail them out. And it doesn't take much insight to see that a society that actually takes away the rewards and punishments for trying to manage your affairs will create a situation where everybody wants to make a claim on the insurance company, but there's nobody who's a net contributor to pay out. I mean, we as a people can't actually relieve ourselves of the obligation to try and exercise some care when we go about our business, and then expect everybody else who's equally careless to put their hand in their empty pocket and bail us out. The only reason why there can be careless drivers is because most drivers aren't careless. And then the more careful drivers find out that over the course of their life, the cost of the insurance was greater than the repairs on their cars, because they had fewer accidents than could have been paid for by their premiums. Their premiums went to pay repairs for other careless drivers. In order to have some people who are reckless idiots, there have to be many who aren't reckless idiots. But an entire society can't say, I'm not going to think about £500 billion worth of COVID debt. I'm not going to think about whether this particular strategy makes any sense. I'm not going to think about anything that otherwise would affect me, because I'm going to assume that the collective got a responsibility to relieve me of the obligation, or relieve me from the consequences of my blindness and my unwillingness to think. And as I say, we're waiting for the other shoe to drop when it comes to the Evergrande company. The shares have been suspended in Hong Kong, I think, this morning. And if it blows up and has systemic consequences, for most people, when it appears as the number one item on the national news, that'll be the first time they've heard of it. In a very short period of time, Labour have recovered a lead over the Conservatives. The movement against Boris Johnson in the last few months, and why did I say Boris Johnson? Because that's pretty much how most people conceive of the Conservatives. They don't think of themselves as voting for a political party, they think of themselves as voting for a leader, as if our parliamentary system were a presidential system. But the movement against Boris Johnson, and ergo the movement against the Conservatives, has been incredibly sharp. And it has happened without anything really changing in Labour's policies, or indeed in the Conservatives' policies. And you would wonder why, how that could be possible. And the answer, of course, is that in exactly the same way that people view the COVID crisis or alcohol as a supposed health benefit, or the possibility of a global financial crisis based on collapsing bond prices and rising bond yields or detonating property companies, in exactly the same way, people don't really think things through and try and penetrate beneath the surface. They think in headline terms. So why did the Conservative Party win in 2019? Because we had to get Brexit done. That was why they won. No real depth behind it. Certainly nobody was voting for some of the things that have happened since when it comes to the highest burden of taxation and the highest debt burden for the best part of half a century. Nobody was voting for the tolerance that's been demonstrated for shenanigans and the terrible lack of care when it came to spending the money that was going to bail us out of the supposed consequences of the COVID crisis. You can argue about whether the COVID crisis or our response has been the greater harm. There's an old saying, of course, the cure is worse than the disease. And depending on what happens in the future, when it comes to bond yields, we may find out the cure is worse than the disease. But when it comes to the sudden move back to the Labour Party, the big sharp lead in the so-called Red Wall constituencies, how is that possible? Well, go to any of those Red Wall constituencies and ask them how they voted in 2019. And people will say, I voted for Boris Johnson. And you say, who was the Tory candidate in your constituency? They won't know. They won't understand how the electoral system works. For 170 years, the Electoral Reform Society have been trying to explain to people how the electoral system works. And again, I wouldn't mind if people just didn't give a damn. But what they actually do is they give the wrong kind of damn. If you think back to 2011, people absolutely refused to take 2 seconds to understand the alternative vote system. But they took an hour to vote against it. And you know, you just wonder, what is it in the national mood? What is it in the orientation towards the public realm that allows people to take no care whatsoever in how they exercise their civic duty, but to go to enormous lengths in many cases to exercise their civic duty, to stop off at 9:30 at night and go into a primary school to vote against the alternative vote system in order to do your civic duty? And yet if somebody said to you, what exactly is the alternative vote system? How does it change the choices facing the voter? And what pressure would it put on the rational politician? They haven't got a clue. No idea. Most people will say they're against PR. The alternative vote system has got nothing to do with PR. But that didn't seem to matter in 2011. So how is it possible for the Labour Party to go from being completely and utterly unelectable and Starmer a joke to being the party that seems as if it's going to be at least a minority government held in place by the Lib Dems or the SNP? They could even win a majority according to some polls. How is that possible? Because the public just are really superficial and glib in the judgments that they make. This is why Nicola Sturgeon triumphs in Scotland, because she's got a lectern. And a lectern is really what you need. A lectern and a calm manner under questioning. So the only time the public will pay close attention is when the guy from the Daily Mail asks a question which you regard as impertinent and you lose your temper. And then people notice. But as long as you're continually talking in an even tone, it's going to actually decode what you're saying. Right now, the COVID reaction, the COVID response in Scotland, the measures that were put in place by the Scottish Government 10 days ago have produced utter and complete merry hell. Yesterday, in response to a question, I think it was Jason Leach, one of the key advisors, said that maybe we'd have no large gatherings until spring. Now, it looks as if, and looked from the start, as if the new variant of COVID might be about a ninth as likely to put you in intensive care as earlier variants, with far more people infected and a dramatic reduction in the number in intensive care. So given the vaccination programme, which of course has a massive impact, it's looking as if maybe it's about a ninth as likely to put you into intensive care. And indeed, I think Leach said that the way we're going to get out of this crisis is for a variant of COVID to emerge which will essentially act as a natural, highly effective, broad-spectrum vaccine against all possible, or almost all possible, future variants. And then he quickly said, but Omicron isn't it. Well, it might well be that Omicron is it. But as I say, we end up judging in headline terms across the board. And the reason why Boris Johnson can be hung by the petard of this kind of glib judgment, this kind of quick rush to judgment, the reason why he can be hung in that way is because he rose in that way. So in 2019 election was essentially a knee-jerk reaction to consternation produced in the voter by 3 years of Anna Soubry and others seeking to frustrate the Brexit process. And people vote for a Conservative Party on that basis. Now, of course, if you tried to persuade folk that if they'd voted for the alternative vote system in 2011, there would never have been a leaving of the EU. There would never, probably never have been a Scottish independence referendum. There would never have been a rightward lurch in politics. Every single MP, if we had voted for Brexit, every single MP would have been acutely aware of what those who voted for the minor party candidates thought, and therefore they'd have been desperate to get some kind of accommodation with the EU, probably an agreement to the customs union but not the internal market, that would have kept as many people on board. All those Tories who didn't take 50% of the vote would have known that they were going to be reliant on the second preferences of Liberal Democrats and others, and therefore they would have a far more responsible politics. But that wasn't what happened. And you can't persuade people that, as I said from the very start here today, you can't persuade people that there's a complex story that lies behind the thing that's the final expression of the tension, if you like. You can't persuade people essentially that the crack that is opening up under their feet is caused by tectonic forces far below, and they need to be understood. You can't persuade people that the reason why the engine, the way you fix the engine is not to actually muffle the noise that it's making, is to fix the thing that's causing the noise. The noise is there for a reason. The reason why Boris Johnson exists is because the engine isn't working properly. And it's no good trying to actually coerce Boris Johnson into being a more responsible individual when the system is designed to produce people like Boris Johnson. I mean, really, the electoral system that we have has been a standing joke for almost any political scientist who is looking to teach students in Germany or France or anywhere else about bad politics. If you're teaching students and you want them to understand why the Americans' version of our first-past-the-post system is nothing like as damaging as the British version, because they open up candidate selection to the wider public, if you try and persuade people of this, they don't really care. And British politicians who do understand how the system works and do understand its weakness, like, for example, Ruth Davidson, who have floated the idea of open primaries in the past, they don't have any traction. People find it extremely difficult to say the world is as it is for reasons, and people do what they do based on the system and the choices and the incentives that you offer them. So you'd better understand why things are the way they are, and you'd better understand what a rational decision maker would do to suit themselves, and then change the world on that basis. People find that really, really loathsome and tedious and boring, and to return to my 16-year-old with our hands on our hips, a lot of shite. If you have wind turbines, as we do in Scotland, and they produce a lot of electricity when the wind blows, what do you do when the wind stops? Because there's a story today that the European Commission is going to label nuclear and certain kinds of gas generation as being green. Now, of course, Nicola Sturgeon has pretty much told the northeast of Scotland that oil and gas has to close. That's the gist of it. Maybe I'm overstating it slightly for the political effect, but that's the gist of it. The European Commission today is causing a huge amount of anger among progressives because they're saying that nuclear and certain kinds of gas are green. If you've got a wind turbine or many wind turbines, and when the wind blows, they provide a lot of electricity, what happens when the wind stops? Well, you need another source of electricity. Could that be using potential energy? In other words, when the wind blows hard, can you store energy in batteries or pump water up a hill and then provide what the wind provided when the wind doesn't blow? Well, back of an envelope calculations tell you that that can't be done. You can store nothing like enough to get you through weeks of still air, which is happens sometimes, particularly winter when there's high pressure. Okay, how about then nuclear? Well, see, the problem with nuclear is that most of the CO2 cost is actually in building the station at the start. Making the station run hot the whole time is no difficulty if it can run hot some of the time. So if you're going to replace your electricity with nuclear when the wind doesn't blow, you'd be better replacing your turbines with nuclear all the time, because the turbines involve huge amounts of steel and huge amounts of maintenance, all of which is massively carbon dioxide intensive. So if your nuclear is going to replace wind turbines when the wind doesn't blow, it should replace the wind turbines all the bloody time. Because if it can replace them some of the time, it doesn't cost any extra CO2 to replace them all of the time. So once you think through the actual engineering problem, you know that you either have to have just nuclear all the time and no turbines, or turbines and gas. No other solution makes any sense whatsoever. Why does that little bit of reasoning there not have any traction in the public imagination? How is it possible for Patrick Harvey and Lorna Slater and loads of other people in Scotland to talk utter arrant nonsense all day, every day, and get away with it? And again, because we don't really care. We care, but we don't care. We care to the extent that we would like it to be better if somebody would wave a magic wand and no real thought was required on our part. But we don't care enough to actually do anything about it. We don't care enough to say to SNP and Green canvassers, look, we need to build nuclear power stations. Because if you think about it logically, we need something when the wind doesn't blow. And the only thing that can be is either massive storage or nuclear or gas. And if nuclear can provide the storage, the power when we need it, when the wind doesn't blow and storage is impossible, then it has to be nuclear all the time and no wind turbines. Or alternatively, it has to be turbines plus gas, in which case you can forget all about no fracking and you can forget all about no North Sea industry because we need massive amounts of gas when the wind doesn't blow. So it's simple. Turbines plus gas or nuclear all the time. Choose. But we don't have that political discourse. We don't have that kind of discussion with elected politicians because, as somebody said to me in Kilmarnock, a guy with a nice house, so probably with a nice job, at 11:30 in the morning, he was taking his kid to an independent school. The kid came out with his blazer on and they were going to a 12 grand a year independent school. So a bloke who had a few quid. And why did he vote Green? Because of values. Did he understand anything about the policies? Nah, but values. One of the values he didn't have was actually thinking things through. Refusing to think things through is also instrumental underpinning for a couple of other major stories today in Scotland. People are talking about Home Rule again. Now, God give me strength in this time of trouble. People talk about Home Rule and they talk about federalism. Journalists, political journalists who should know better, continually babble on about federalism and Home Rule. Now, these terms are what's called stipulative. In other words, you have to stipulate what you mean. When someone says, when your doctor says, you have to take up a sport for the good of your health, well, what do you mean by a sport doctor? Do you include darts? Do you include, snooker? So what do you mean by a sport? Could it be just anything that somebody might call a sport, or does it have to be something like badminton or tennis or jogging? So these terms are stipulative. You have to define what you mean. So the expression Home Rule doesn't mean anything, but within the ALBA SNP group, particularly ALBA, there's now talk about Kenny McCaskill, the former Justice Minister. Kenny McCaskill is talking about Home Rule. So maybe the independence campaign can't actually work at the moment because the UK government is going to keep saying no, and therefore there can't be a proper referendum, and therefore there's going to have to be a third option that the UK government might agree to, which might actually also win the support of the broad majority of the Scottish population rather than a bare 50.01% or whatever. So they're talking about Home Rule, and what Home Rule involves is complete devolution of everything. This is the most common definition. Complete devolution of everything, but you pay a sum of money for foreign affairs and defence to the national government. So Scotland would run its own affairs in every regard, apart from paying a sum of money to the national government. Now, it's hard to know where to start with this, but the easiest place to start with is the 36.3 billion that we spent last year that we couldn't raise in taxation. And people say all countries are borrowing money, and the whole of the UK borrowed the money, not just Scotland. However, when you look at the actual spending of the money across the UK, far, far more was spent in Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland per head of population than spent in other, well, in England, particularly outside London in the South East. So we know that Scotland has got a massive fiscal deficit. We know that if Scotland gained control of other taxes, like, for example, corporation tax, or the personal allowance. At the moment, they can't actually change the personal allowance, so they can't take away a £12,500 personal allowance. They can't levy taxes in corporations. That's reserved to the UK government. Now, if for the sake of argument you gave the Scottish government corporation tax powers and other powers over taxation, for example, the personal allowance, and you took away the £15,000 that they currently get. In terms of a fiscal transfer, effectively, or alternatively, alternative, you demanded payment for defence and foreign affairs and turned off the actual fiscal transfer of the usual 10, 11 billion. If you did any of that, what exactly would happen to the Scottish economy? Because it's one of two things. One is you slash the wages of all the public sector workers, and if it's complete fiscal autonomy, if it's complete devolution of all functions, including welfare, with only defence and foreign affairs paid for by a payment to Westminster, then you slash welfare benefits as well. Now, within one United Kingdom, what does that do to population movement? Who moves across to England from a Scotland that has slashed public sector pay and slashed welfare benefits in order to try and balance the books and hiked up corporation tax? Because it would seem to me pretty obvious that if Kate Forbes, the finance secretary, and Nicola Sturgeon are able to raise taxation on high earners and actually get it tax negative, they actually got less tax from the high earners by raising taxes than they would have got if they kept it at 40%. The new 41% is tax negative. If that's what they're capable of doing, if Nicola Sturgeon doesn't know what quantitative easing is 7 years after it started or 8 years after it started, if Kate Forbes can actually ask on a Zoom call recently, would it really be a bad thing if we couldn't engage in quantitative easing? Okay, if this is the kind of level of political discourse, this is the standard of reasoning, if this is what we get from our politicians, what do you think they could do with complete home rule and full fiscal autonomy and a complete and utter willingness to do whatever would please their base, regardless of the medium-term consequences? Because, of course, this morning we discover that the promised doubling of child child welfare payments, which was said in May 2021 when it looked as if the SNP might not get their majority in the Scottish Parliament, they're now saying this will prove impossible, it might not be done, just like the free bikes and the iPads and loads of other things as well. So given that we've got a pretty good track record of saying whatever is necessary to get us out of a bind, to get us through the next day or even the next hour, what do you think would happen with complete home rule, full fiscal autonomy, complete control of a corporation tax and other taxes as well, including the personal allowance, and a cohort of voters that vote for the dominant party in Scotland who are susceptible to the kind of shenanigans that we heard in May when they were told that the world was the best of all possible worlds they had nothing to complain about from the SNP's government for the previous 5 years. Everything that that hadn't been done to their satisfaction was a consequence of Westminster's backsliding and a failure to give Scotland the levers it required. And then we find a mere 7 months on that the things that were said in that election to win it are now, some of them haven't been done at all, and some are now being said that we're now being told they won't be done. What would that government do, given even more power and an obligation to pay the Westminster government for defence and foreign affairs? I think that probably we could grant home rule and prevent independence for the simple reason that we would sicken so many people so quickly that there'd be no call for devolution at all, never mind for enhanced devolution and home rule. We would probably reverse out of home rule so fast it would make people dizzy. If you're living in Scotland, you might have seen the Hogmanay, which is New Year's Eve for non-Scots. You might have seen the Hogmanay January the 1st shenanigans in a pub in the centre of Glasgow near the Merchant City called the Avant-Garde. And I've been roundly abused and attacked on social media for taking the view that the people who were told to leave the pub by the police should have got up and left the pub, and that bracing your arms out, sticking your chest out, and talking at one inch into a police officer's face, telling him that he won't tell you what to do, and keeping that going for 2 minutes, and then telling the cops flatly that you're not going to comply and you're not going to leave the pub, and the pub has been closed, and the police have told you it's been closed, and they've told you you're going to be arrested, and you've watched somebody be arrested, and you're still not going to move. I've suggested that really a society can't proceed on that basis, and that if people have a right to actually decide that there and then on the spot, rather than through the electoral process and through the political process, that certain laws won't be enforced, then this way anarchy lies. and people get very annoyed with me, and I've had to unfollow and block quite a lot of people because I can't stand to listen to their rambling. And it's an example of, as I've said before, right at the start, of a broader problem, which is that we don't really think that we should exercise any care when, for example, we vote for politicians, because we can always find a way to engage in special pleading afterwards. So if, for the sake of argument, we voted for the SNP in 2021, having seen, for example, the hate crime bill and the new legislation get implemented in Scotland, which has made us not just figures of ridicule, but figures of pity and contempt across the free world. People looking, and there was lots of news reports in the United States and in Australia over this hate crime bill. Scotland, the land of the Enlightenment, Scotland, the country that gave us the modern world, according to at least one academic, Scotland doing things like that. Now, we've got these COVID regulations, we've got loads of licensing laws, we've got council elections coming up in May, and we've got people who think that you can sit in a pub which has been closed by the police and refuse to comply, and that's workable. So that in principle, people could decide that the police can't enforce any laws without a long discussion, without de-escalation, without a huge attempt to maintain the peace in the face of people who are determined to try and compromise the peace and defy them. And I had a difficult time trying to reason with a former student who finally fell out with me after a year and a half of it, when he would go round the houses repeatedly on, if you think the COVID reaction, if you think the reaction to COVID has been ill-judged and that the strategy has been flawed, as you plainly do, why don't you agree with me that we should just start disobeying the law and defy the police and have a popular rebellion and actually and try and wash away the state almost, or to certainly transform it. Now, if we go back to the 18th century and David Hume and the other thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment, Hume and others noted that justice is an artificial virtue. And what he meant by that was, it's extremely important that you evolve a system of mine and thine distinct. You know, it's important that you actually have property, and it's important that you enforce the rules in every single case. The miser who drops his purse in the street must have it returned to him. And if you look at the purse and you look at the money and you recognize the miser will never actually spend it well, then you would think that the most important thing would be to take the money and give it to the poor so that you could promote more happiness. But in actual fact, because of this tendency towards backsliding, because of this tendency to look upon a person as being evicted and think, well, they mustn't be evicted. Look at how could any considerate, compassionate person want to evict this poor person here in order that this rich landlord can have their property back and get yet more rent? Anybody would look at that situation and their heart would go out to the tenant. Now, that's fine. The one thing you mustn't do, however, is actually keep the tenant in that property by refusing to enforce the law. What you can do is you can postulate a different law and then have a political argument of what the medium-term consequences would be of that law. So if for the sake of argument, you say that landlords shouldn't be able to charge certain rents, you're going to have rent controls, then how will people change their behaviour who would otherwise have bought property and become landlords? Because that's relevant to working out whether there's going to be less or more human misery produced by your rule. If you don't want a rule, if you want to just say people can sit in a pub and chunter at the police and defy them and tell them to F off and refuse to leave, if you want to say that, that's fine. Okay, draft a rule. Licensing laws cannot be enforced if more than 60% of the customers present are over 60 years of age. If you want to draft that as a law and propose that, that's fine. But if you want to say that we can actually have laws that, for example, allow the police to close a licensed premise and ask people to leave, and you want to say that that law should be unenforceable in certain circumstances, like, for example, in Hogmanay or whenever a popular mood seizes a significantly large number of people, contemplate how that will play out and explain to me why it makes for a better world. Because It seems to me that all of the places that people want to live are places where you don't have that kind of caprice. You don't have that kind of not despotism, including benign despotism. A British soldier was talking about handing out blankets and food to folk in some part of the Middle East, and he said, "It's fine if the sheikh's there. They'll pretty much toe the line and behave reasonably and queue up if the sheikh's there. But if he isn't there, it's just a free for all, and there's nothing we can do. They just mob the vehicles, and it's complete chaos." Now, if you want a society where the sheikh can basically say that you have to do this or you have to do that, if you want that kind of autocracy rather than the rule of law, if you'd rather have despotism, perhaps a benign despotism, rather than what's made us rich for the last however many hundred years, if you want to actually say that the West is flawed, and that the rule of law was a mistake, and that procedure is a mistake, and that the most important thing is to just basically follow your sentiments when you're faced with something in particular, whether it's COVID, or people sitting in a pub and being defiant towards the police. If you want to say that your sentiments are a guide to how the society should function, then it really is important that you explain how that will work out. What you think the role of the cops will be, for example, when someone is called to a changing room, and a person who appears to be male and expressing a man's identity is in the changing room, and the changing room is for women. Because people who can't engage, to get back to Effie Deans just to conclude, people who can't engage with the debate about sex and gender and insist that there's no distinction between the two when there very obviously is, and then, because they won't engage with that debate, can't think through what kind of social rules we could have and how they could possibly be enforced by the police and by the courts, they leave you in a situation where the society becomes at war with itself, and you have the woke on the one hand and the so-called reactionary on the other, and a society that's teetering on the brink of anarchy. And on that issue, perhaps there's less at stake. But when it comes to other things, like, for example, foreign affairs and what we can do to maintain peace in Europe, or the welfare state and what we can do to maintain incentives domestically, the fate of the society hangs on it. The other day I was feeling a bit gloomy, and I suggested that maybe this is the sort of Argentinization of the United Kingdom, or maybe of Europe, that we're living through. Argentina was a really productive and successful country, and then went from being, I think, one of the richest, was it fourth richest maybe in the world, to be an absolute basket case in just under a century. So in about 80 years, they managed to completely destroy Argentina. And you look at what's happening in the West at the moment, and you think the fundamental things about liberal democracy that actually made us rich are now contested, or worse still, not even recognised as valuable and just dismissed and rubbished. And you wonder whether that's going to be tenable in the medium term. You wonder whether, in actual fact, we're living right now through what the Chinese call interesting times, and we might find that what comes next is less good than what came before, even if what came before left us dissatisfied. The fact that something wasn't perfect wasn't a reason to think that it wasn't as good as it could be, and we may be playing with fire. Peace.